For the sermon, Mr. Steve Buchanan.
This is an election year, and one of the biggest debates will center and has centered around the economic policy in the United States. And even any casual observer of U.S. affairs would agree that we are in deep, deep financial problem. And the financial problems in the U.S. are only overshadowed perhaps by some of the financial problems in Europe, which even seems to have, with Germany excepted, seems to have far worse problems. And interestingly enough, some officials in Europe of high rank are blaming the U.S. for Europe's economic problems. And, you know, there's probably a little bit of truth to that, too, in the sense that it is a global economy and what we do here affects other nations, and it can't help but affect other nations because we do have this global economy, and problems in the U.S. economy certainly will have their effect on other nations. But come on, there are other causes of European problems, and they have a lot of their own issues to consider as far as the base or the management of their financial issues. Consider the fact that in many European countries, employers are mandated to give paid vacation for up to 6 weeks a year, sometimes even longer than that. Some of the nations in Europe have a retirement age as early as 50 years of age. So I could have moved to Italy 9 years ago and been living the lap, you know, drinking wine on the coast, eating oranges and whatnot. And then, of course, they have, you know, a huge drag on their economic engine with mandated health care policies in many of these nations, socialized medicine, as many of you are aware of. But the economic engine of the U.S. has faltered, and it is having an effect on the rest of the world. And in fact, not only the U.S., but many nations in the world are going through a financial crisis. And this is going to be a subject of great debate in the coming election year. But looking beyond this year, and even beyond this age, what are the basic concepts of economic reform that are going to be eventually practiced in the world tomorrow? And how will these laws and these policies and these reforms result in economic stability in God's kingdom? And importantly, as a child of God and as a son and daughter of God, what can you do to take advantage of those economic policies that will be instituted for the rest of the world later on? Let's take a look first at some of the main problems for our recent financial problems in the United States. It's been a long time since our nation was a creditor nation. I can't remember exactly what the year was when that passed. We used to be a creditor nation. We used to, even as the Bible suggests in Leviticus, we used to be able to lend to other nations, and still we certainly give a great deal to other nations and foreign aid and so forth. But we used to The world used to owe us a lot more than we owe them, and our balance of trade was a lot better than it has been in recent years. But some of the problems, maybe not all of them, but some of the problems came about with the housing problems of a number of years ago, go back maybe even more than a decade ago, where there was a lot of unwise spending and a lot of unwise home loans made to individuals. The housing market was quite a bit less at that time. People were able to get into homes with little or no money down. The housing market began to escalate. The valuation of homes began to go up. And many people borrowed against that incredible equity that had been built up for a few years, maybe a period of, I think, from between 2001 and 2005, the prices of the standard home in the United States went up maybe 30 to 40%. And since the prices went up, the valuation of homes went up, and a lot of people borrow against that equity. And banks were very willing to lend money because that is a moneymaker for them. That's the way they exist. That's the way they make a profit. And so they lent out those home equity loans. And eventually, people couldn't keep up with the increased payments because you always have to pay that money back. So there were defaults, as we know, foreclosures, bankruptcies. That had its ripple effect through the economy, and that began in earnest in about 2006. And then it really hit the fan in 2008. We had monumental problems of consumer debt and U.S. national debt, and the inability to pay back that money. The main underlying problem, I mean, we can talk about, you know, economic curves and philosophy and all sorts of metrics, but the underlying cause is really pretty simple. It's human nature. And a lot of it, there's really no argument. It goes back to specifically greed and deceit. And this has been widely acknowledged by many, many experts. So what did we do about it? In 2008, before the last presidential campaign was over, a massive governmental bailout package was suggested and enacted, and it was suggested if we didn't do this, the bottom was going to fall out of the economy, we would default, we would be in horrible shape. And so they signed into law this massive governmental bailout package. But it really didn't help, as we know. And then there have been further stimulus packages, as well as an expansion of the money supply. So the Federal Reserve has created more and more money, pumped more and more money into the system, and there has been more and more money available, and yet it has devalued the dollar further and further and further. All of these have failed to rescue our economy, and the Keynesian School of Economics has thrown about every single weapon that they possibly can at a problem that will not respond to that kind of methodology. It is impossible for it to respond to it. It just simply does not work. And so our national debt, that which we owe ourselves as a nation, which is not so bad when you owe yourself, but when you owe other countries, then they're going to demand repayment. And so they have not yet demanded the repayment because we've been able to make those payments to the nations that we are indebted to, Great Britain, European nations, China specifically. But that toll on our economy and that drag on our economy continues to get worse and worse, and it's increased from $9 trillion, which is a number that none of us can really explain, to $15 trillion, almost $16 trillion now in national debt that we owe. And if the Supreme Court next week in a landmark ruling allows another massive governmental program to be enacted, the health care initiative, it is going to provide an unbelievable drag on the economy and will wreck us even worse. So we don't know. No one has a crystal ball, and no one knows what is going to happen to that. But if enacted, it will have an incredible ripple effect on our economy. As a nation, even now at this late stage, with things being so dire in terms of the trillions of dollars that we owe, the economic problems that we have are solvable. They're solvable, really, but whether or not the political will exists remains to be seen. Recently, for instance, a local candidate for Congress to fill Gabrielle Giffords' seat was defeated for the congressional seat for the next few months to fill that until the next election. And some experts believe that he was defeated by his own words that he uttered about 4 years ago in the first time that he lost to Gabrielle Giffords, the Republican challenger, because in a town meeting or wherever it was, they took the comment out of context, but he talked about Social Security being a Ponzi scheme. And so they replay that over and over and over again on the airwaves. And, well, before I make my next comment, let me ask you, how many of you, don't be embarrassed, you know, because you paid all your lives into it, and we're dealing with more or less a senior crowd, but how many of you receive in some way, even if it's a small amount, a Social Security check every month? Don't be shy. So the majority of the room. So all the rest of us are having to carry you. I've got to running joke with Mr. Christensen about, you know, how happy he is when he opens up his Social Security check. He always thinks of me every time, and me and Terry paying into the Social Security system every month. Well, you know, I hate to say it, but frankly, it is a Ponzi scheme. I mean, plain words need to be spoken. Social Security is a Ponzi scheme. Now, it probably wasn't intended to be that way because the average life expectancy in the 1930s was probably just over 50 for most people. I mean, the average life expectancy. And so there wasn't going to be that long that people would be on Social Security. They'd pay into it, you know, through their lives, and there'd be money there, take it out, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But it's a system that is failing. And everybody knows it's going to be failing, but it's political suicide to suggest, as George W. Bush did a few years ago, that maybe we need to privatize part of it. Oh, no, AARP got so crazy over that. Privatize, he's going to take away our Social Security and mobilizing all the seniors to vote against all the Republicans and so on and so on and so forth. But frankly, right now it is a Ponzi scheme because in the beginning there were probably, I can't remember, it was like 240 people paying into it for every person that were taking benefits out. Now it's like four people are paying into it for every one person is taking out. So it's just dramatically gone bad and the benefits increase. And, you know, what? There isn't even any Social Security fund. Do you realize that? There is no fund with money in it in a bank anywhere that anybody can go and say, you know, count silver, gold, bullion, cash, or anything else that is Social Security, because they long ago spent all of that money. Remember the great debate in 2000 in the presidential election about the lockbox? You know, the lockbox. It was a lockbox that all that money went into the lockbox. It could be used for nothing else other than Social Security. It was a hoax. There never was any lockbox. They began raiding this extensive fund of money that is paid in. And so everything, don't feel guilty now, those of you that are receiving a check. Don't feel too guilty. Maybe feel a little bit guilty. Every time you receive a check, every time you receive that Social Security check, yes, you. There is nothing. It is, we are borrowing money in order to pay you, Joe, your Social Security check. So really now, it is kind of a Ponzi scheme. But it's really pretty simple. I don't want to take away your Social Security check. I'm just hoping to hold on so that I can have it in a few years, right? But it's really pretty simple. Policy decisions have gotten us into this mess, and a change of policy could change it. It's highly unlikely that that's ever going to happen. But since it is a policy decision that has been made and it's a bad decision, then the good decisions could eventually reverse that. So I don't mean to imply that all the financial problems of the world could be solved if we could just make better decisions, but at least we could eliminate a lot of indebtedness. But as for the future, the good news is that the economic issues, which really, when you come down to it, are simply moral issues, do have a godly recipe for solving those problems. Now, we know that our future is outlined by the holy days. We have the spring holy days and we have the fall holy days. We have the spring holy days where there is an individual focus, and we've just finished that set of holy days. And that's where it should begin. And in the world tomorrow, it's going to be again with an individual focus. For all those who survive, and at the beginning of the millennium, it's going to be an individual focus. They are going to focus on each individual's responsibility to God. And that's what we do every spring. With the Passover, we recognize Jesus Christ as our Passover to deliver us from sins, from the bondage of sin. The days of unleavened bread, putting sin out and putting on righteousness by partaking of unleavened bread, moving to the day of Pentecost, which we've just finished, which shows us that even while we've done all of that, we still need the power of the Holy Spirit to guide, to motivate, and help us to replace human nature with the nature of God, the deceitful, even greedy nature that can become human beings at times with the nature of God. And then the fall holy days, of course, have a national and international scope because trumpets shows the beginning of the millennial rule of Jesus Christ with his return, atonement, the putting out of Satan so all mankind can experience what God's people have individually experienced throughout 6,000 years of man's rule, because there have been people of God throughout all of that particular time. Satan is no longer going to be able to stir up humankind, human greed, human avarice, and that will be a solution of and by itself. And if we read in Romans chapter 8 in verse 7, we know that this is an essential truth about the human condition it plainly labels who and what we have all been. And Paul makes the point also in Ephesians chapter 2 that we've all come out of that system. You can't help but live in this world and be affected by that greedy, avarice system. And Romans 8 and verse 7 says, the carnal mind is hostile towards God. It is not subject to the law of God, nor indeed can be. Now, does that mean that there aren't people that believe in God? Does that mean that there aren't people that don't have good motivations and consciences and want to do the right thing? Of course not. But when you get down to it, man is lacking the Spirit of God to motivate him to a godly decision. And that is the key. Man essentially is, simply because of his exposure to this world, the spirit of this world, which is brought out in the book of Corinthians. 1 Corinthians mentions, 1 Corinthians 2, as you know, mentions three spirits. The spirit of man, the spirit of this world, and the spirit of God. And so the spirit of this world is motivated by the devil, and all humankind has been subject to it. The spirit in man is that which is very neutral and helps us to do things that, you know, the animals cannot do. And the Spirit of God helps us and enables us to do the things that only the family of God can do. So when Satan is removed, the cause of that hostility to God and his laws goes away, and repentant mankind is then motivated to become more like God and to learn the nature of God, and people be receptive and submissive to the law of God, and they'll be able to experience the positive benefits of obedience, all of those things which, by the way, all of us are subject to now and can receive and be the beneficiaries of at this particular time. Matthew 6 and verse 24. First, let's understand some foundational principles. What are some of the positive economic benefits of this change of human nature? There is this foundation that is going to be easily understood when all of the distractions are removed and people will be able to understand, oh, yeah, I get it. But Matthew 6 and verse 24 says, no one can serve two masters, for you'll hate one and love the other. You'll be devoted to one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money, or mammon, as it may be in some translations. You can't put God first and put material wealth first as well. Now, does that mean that there's something wrong with money, or that there's something inherently evil about it, or that there's something inherently wrong about being successful? Obviously not. Don't be silly. But putting God first is the key and a fundamental principle in the world tomorrow, which will be taught along with Matthew 6, verse 33, seek ye first the kingdom of God, and all these things shall be added to you. But everyone is going to be motivated, first of all, to serve and please God. That's going to be the fundamental and the primary motivation of mankind. And instead of just having an interest in accumulating things, wealth and power and that sort of thing, then it will be putting God first. And the sources of worry over money, and which of us in our lives haven't worried about money in some way? I mean, that is a typical thing for people to be worried about. But if you remove the source of worry that is about money, because people are going to be taught sound economic principles from the Bible, there is going to be prosperity aplenty for everyone when that is the rule rather than the exception. So serving God first and being taught to put God first and serve God first in every way in life is going to be the foundational principle, and that in itself will begin to help yield prosperity for all. Another thing that is going to happen is that the golden rule will be enforced, and everybody will eventually, a few years into the millennium, people are going to say, you know what, I'd like to, let's just say there'll be cars. I don't know if there will be cars. I'm sure there will, but, you know, some would you rather me use horses. Okay, that's fine. Think horse when I say car. If you want to sell somebody a car, they may say, okay, I'll give you $5,000 or shekels or whatever the denomination of the money exchange will be at that time. Are you sure? I don't, you know, as the seller, are you sure? I don't really think so. I don't think I can take a penny over 3,000 shekels. Oh, wait a minute. No, I don't want to take advantage of you. Let's settle on 4,000. You know, people will be motivated to seek the well-being of others rather than self-interest. And that's going to be another fundamental principle which will help the entire society of the world tomorrow be successful. In other words, people growing up in a system after Christ is returned are going to be encouraged to trust God first and to have faith that needed material things, which are a part of life. I mean, we need things. We need some kind of things. We have to have clothing. We have to have food as human beings. We have to have protection. We have to have a home over our heads. But people will not be frantic about wondering if they're going to be able to do that. If you have that worry and that fear removed, then everybody is going to be able to live as an example for us all, like Paul did in Hebrews chapter 13, verse 5. You know, this will be the rule rather than the exception. Now, I can't wave a magic wand for anybody, even especially for myself, and say, oh, all the money worries are going to disappear, because we still live in a world that is contrary to God. And it's very, very tough. And, you know, when I get to another part of the sermon, you'll see just exactly how tough it is and why it is so difficult to make ends meet, no matter what your level of income. Well, maybe if you're a billionaire or whatever. I don't hate billionaires or, you know, anybody like that. I admire them. I mean, if they're honest and they've done it the right way and, you know, they've just used their ingenuity and, you know, they've succeeded, I admire them. I think that's great. Hebrews 13 and verse 5 says, another fundamental principle, let your conduct be without covetousness. Without covetousness. That's the 10th commandment. Be content with such things as you have, for he himself has said, I will never leave you nor forsake you. Won't it be great when everybody is taught these principles and everybody's kind of walking along in the same direction, trust and faith, not taking advantage of anybody else, not even worrying about getting the best of the deal, but trying to give the best of the deal in every case, and knowing that God is going to be there to back you up. Paul also said in 1 Timothy 6 and verse 8, having food and clothing, with these we shall be content. Well, he had mastered it. He had found a way to support himself, to be able to take care of his needs, and, you know, obviously grew up, I think, in a well-to-do home of material means, but throughout his life, he learned what the important things were. Philippians 4 and verse 13, he also wrote in this particular passage that there's another aspect of the contentment and the peace and tranquility that he was able to find, finding peace and contentment, because he said, not that I speak in regard to need, for I have learned in whatever state I am to be content. I know how to be abased and I know how to abound. He did both. He was in both positions. And I'll bet in some way or another, all of us in this room have kind of been in the same boat. We have had to learn to be abased. We've had to learn to abound. There's been times when we've had good jobs, times when we had bad jobs, times when we've needed things, and times when we've been rather content. It is possible that the first generation of the world tomorrow will have to do a little bit without. And I remember my dad talking about the Great Depression, and some of you grew up in a Great Depression, and the Great Depression and World War II were the foundational, fundamental things that shaped his life. As a teenager growing up in Niagara Falls, New York, he had to drop out of high school. He did take the New York boards. I mean, in New York State, they have boards that you had to pass, and they're pretty stringent. In order to get a high school diploma, you had to take your boards and pass them, and he did pass them even though he had to drop out and work at three different jobs, and jobs were tough to find in those days. And so he had three part-time jobs in which he helped support his family. But, you know, I've heard every saying that every child of the 60s and the 70s has heard in regard to, you know, doing without and making do with what you have, and being questioned as to whether or not I thought my father owned the electric company because I left a light on for 5 minutes longer than it should have been in a room. But we grew up with that, and it was hammered within us that, you know, you just have to learn to make do sometimes. And some of you grew up in those conditions as well, probably all of you to one extent or another. But people growing up in that first generation are probably going to learn that lesson very well, and things will change quickly from that time, because there are going to be some just very simple things that will make a huge difference, and we won't have all of this government borrowing and government overspending. And, you know, very rarely in the last half of the 20th century did the United States actually take in more money and revenue than it gave out. And there were a few times in which it had a balanced budget, but not too often. It would be so simple to do that. All you'd have to do is stop spending so much money. But governments, as we'll see, are not inclined to do that. They're inclined to always expand, no matter how diligent the reformer's mind is to change it. It just is an animal that continues to grow and the beast continues to be fed. So Paul learned to do, you know, what he could. He said, everywhere and in all things I've learned both to be full and to be hungry, both to abound and to suffer need. And I think all of us would agree that as my dad taught us as kids, that some of the times of greatest need from a material sense were even at times some of the happiest times, when you had to invent fun, you had to invent things to do to be able to take care of. Sometimes the families drew closer together because of that need. And that certainly has been a lesson that many people have had to learn. But in the new economy, in the world tomorrow, people will learn the importance of contentment as a key to true wealth. And I think they'll be far wealthier than the average person in our society today. I really do. Give it a few years, maybe a generation, maybe even not a generation. I think people will be far more wealthier, the average person. Some will excel. They'll have more ability. They'll be more wealthy. But the average person will be far wealthier than the individual in today's world. Let's turn to Ephesians chapter 4. Ephesians 4, verses 20 through 24, another key principle of, maybe you wouldn't necessarily apply it to economics, but you probably should. Ephesians 4 and verse 20, but you have not so learned Christ, if indeed you have heard him and have been taught by him, as the truth is in Jesus, that you put off concerning your former conduct the old man, which goes corrupt according to the deceitful lusts, and be renewed in the spirit of your mind, and that you put on the new man, which was created according to God in true righteousness and holiness. And as I said, the whole world will learn that from an individual perspective with the spring holy days, and they'll begin with me. They'll begin with the individual, and they'll begin by looking at themselves and wondering, okay, how do I conduct myself in this new society, in this new world? What is God expecting of me? Where do I need to change? And this will be the challenge to everyone at that particular time. And that is why there will be many teachers to be needed. And that is why you are qualifying at this particular time. That is why God has called you now, so that you can say, you know what? To your city or to your town or whatever, whomever you rule over, however many you rule over, I've been there. I've done this. And you know what? It was a lot tougher back in the old world, when Satan was running around influencing people. So don't tell me you can't do it. You'll be able to help people to understand, because you've gone through that. And it's amazing what a few small changes in a spiritual sense will make in terms of physical and material wealth. There won't be any need for truth in lending practices, because everybody is going to be honest with one another in all of their transactions. So let's take a look at some laws that we can point to in the Bible that deal with economics that will be in force during the millennium. You know, one of the great things will be a balanced approach in understanding land ownership. And that is going to be one of the foundations of the modern economy, is land ownership, with a caveat, because if you look at Psalm 24, there is a qualification to land ownership which everybody is going to participate in. Now, some of you own homes, some of you don't. But some of you may own some land. You may have a couple acres. You may, you know, own land elsewhere in some other state. Everybody is going to have an opportunity to own land. And that's going to create a tremendous foundation for the economy of the world tomorrow. But with this caveat in Psalm 24 and verse 1, the earth and everything in it, the world and its inhabitants belong to the Lord, for he laid its foundation on the seas and established it on the rivers. So this is a theme that is shown throughout the Bible, that ownership of land is not a bad thing, but each individual has to realize you're not really owning it. You own it, but you may be on the deed, but you're kind of renting this for a while because God is the real owner and you're just borrowing it for the period of time, brief period of time that you're on this earth. In Acts 17 and verse 26, there is a truth here that applies to all of the nations and which will be applicable to all of the nations. And this is quoted from Deuteronomy 32 and verse 8. But Acts 17 and verse 26 from the New Revised Standard Version, it says, from one ancestor he made all nations to inhabit the whole earth. That is, from Adam. He made all the nations from Adam to inhabit the whole earth, and he allotted the times of their existence and the boundaries of the places where they would live. So now we know we have many artificial boundaries around the world, many different nations that are even kind of artificially created through war. You know, many nations, even in the Middle East, their boundaries have been altered and so on and so forth because of war and because, well, in the early 1900s, Britain was able to draw up some boundaries and, you know, they decreed this and that, and some of them have changed a little bit or a lot throughout the years. But God is going to put people where it is best for them. He's going to put them back where it is best for them to be. He's going to establish national boundaries so that each group of people will live in the place that is best suited for them. And we just leave that up to God because he's fair and he loves all of mankind, and he is going to put every nation, every group of people, every race, every ethnic group into the area that's best suited for it. And everyone will be able to own their own property to be able to raise food for themselves, which is quite a joy. Many of you have participated in that before, and a lot of the obstacles that are faced with, you know, individuals being able to raise food for themselves, to feed their families, will be removed. But Micah chapter 4 and verse 4, I'll cite two passages for you. They both say essentially the same thing. Micah 4 and verse 4, first of all, and then Zechariah 3:10, for those of you that take notes. But this is a promise, a millennial promise, that each one will sit under his own grapevine or under his own fig tree without any fear. And the Lord who commands armies has decreed it. And then in Zechariah 3 and verse 10, in that day, says the Lord who rules over all, everyone will invite his friend to fellowship under his vine and under his fig tree. In the marginal notes of the New English Testament, it says, the imagery of fellowship under his vine and under his fig tree describes the peaceful dominion of the Lord in the coming messianic age. Now, if you've ever been able, and I don't know who in this room would not have been able to do this, if you've ever been able to get out into nature, sit by a tranquil lake, sit by the ocean, hike up into the mountains, wherever it is that you like best on this earth, wherever it is that you could describe that is the most peaceful place that I've ever been, and that's where I felt more at home, then you've already experienced that kind of millennial peace that everyone will experience every day. Every day they'll experience, you know, I don't know how often that's happened to you in your lifetime. It's happened to me a lot. You know, I've been to some nice places and I've just, you know, sometimes I've been with myself. Sometimes I've been with my family. I've sat there by the seashore or by a lake up in a mountain camping. Terry's not so much in camping anymore. Someplace nicer than a campground, you know, but peaceful, alone, tranquil. You've already experienced that kind of peace that will prevail for all of mankind, and you've understood, at least in type, what will be the norm in the future. It's not going to be very long. But you might say, how is this going to be possible with the population explosion that will happen even during the millennium? Because although it appears from Bible prophecy that not a lot of mankind, not as many as are living now, will, you know, travail from one generation to the next or one society to the next, there will be some. But after a while, with all this vine and fig tree going on and people being happy, there is going to be a veritable population explosion. And where are you going to put all those people? Well, it will happen because of God's land reform program. And it's going to be huge. It's going to be unlike anything that has ever taken place because there's going to be supernatural power involved. In Isaiah 35 and in verse 1, we read that there is going to be such a change, even in the Sonoran Desert. I don't even know if saguaro cactus will still be natural to this area because it won't be desert anymore. And it's kind of a different desert than, you know, let's say the Mojave Desert. Anyway, we know that. It's lush, so it won't take as much to change this here. And those of you that have gardens know that even in the desert soil of the Southwest, you add a little water, things can grow. So there will be magnificent change that will take place. Isaiah 35 and verse 1, the wilderness and the wasteland shall be glad for them, and the desert shall rejoice and blossom as the rose. It shall blossom abundantly and rejoice, even with joy and singing. For water shall burst forth in the wilderness, streams in the desert. And it's not going to be desert for very long. The parched ground shall become a pool, and the thirsty land springs of water. Now, it really doesn't take much imagination in your mind to know that this will be a reality. It doesn't take a lot of change. It just takes a little rain in due season for this to happen to where virtually everything would be far more beautiful than the area out by north of Tancaverde. What's the little small lake out there where we used to live, the park? Agua Caliente Park. Yeah, everything will be like that around here, but it'll be much better than that. I think they could mow the grass out there a little bit better than they do and maybe clean up the barbecues, but everything is going to be nicer than that in this area. The parched ground shall become a pool and thirsty land, springs of water. In the habitation of jackals where each lay, there shall be grass with reeds and rushes. And that's what is there now. That's what caught my eye. Agua Caliente Park is a place we used to go with the kids and throw the frisbee and do that sort of thing. But at the present time, there is a little less than 13 million square miles of desert on the earth. That's a lot. 13 million square miles. By comparison, the total surface area, that's everything of the United States, is less than, it's almost a third of that, 5.9 million square miles. And of that surface, only 19% in the United States, or 1.12 million square miles, is arable land. So how many people could live in an area that's almost two and a half times the size of the U.S. and all of its land now that's usable? A lot. And that doesn't even take into account the fact that the Bible hints that the great oceans that we have now will no longer be necessary. And we won't have as much need for many high mountains where people can't live, and some of that will be leveled as well. Now, if you'll turn to Leviticus 26, we find that the blessings which were promised to Israel, never really truly realized, certainly are going to apply in the world tomorrow. And these will have a profound economic and stabilizing effect for all of mankind because God is going to rain down literally and figuratively all the blessings for obedience that he originally promised to Old Testament Israel. We find here that there's going to be rain in due season. Instead of destructive storms and hurricanes and tornadoes, and even those, you know, their weather patterns are what they are, and their natural tornadoes are a natural consequence of, you know, patterns of cold air, warm air meeting each other and moisture and everything else. And hurricanes are a natural consequence of heat in the tropics being transferred to other areas. They're just very destructive. But if you eliminate the wild swings in the climate, then you eliminate the need for those particular changes that can be very destructive. Leviticus 26, and in verse 9, it says, "For I will look on you favorably and make you fruitfully multiply, and make you fruitful, multiply you, and confirm my covenant with you. You shall eat the old harvest and clear out the new, or clear out the old because of the new. And I will set my tabernacle among you, and my soul shall not abhor you. I will walk among you and be your God, and you shall be my people. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt that you should not be their slaves. I have broken the bands of your yoke and made you to walk upright." Now, that will apply to all nations in the world tomorrow. Surplus food items, instead of being a problem, are going to be a blessing, because in today's economy, sometimes that can be a problem where there's problem in storing food, and that becomes an expensive item. There are not going to be any wars, so there won't be any devastation from wars that actually have been one of the mankind's most horrific things have been wars which limit people's ability to grow food. It's incredible. So all of that is going to be done away. God's economic program has provisions for people who get into financial trouble because of poor decisions. You know, have you made perfect decisions every step of the way financially all of your life? Have you made every single wise decision that anybody could make? That's life, and that's not going to change. People make bad decisions sometimes. We learn, hopefully, from bad decisions and say, wow, that was pretty stupid on my part. I better not do that again. You know, that is, experience is a dear teacher, as they say, but God has a plan to help those people. And sometimes that is a very beneficial way to learn a lesson. It's not going to be a $700 billion bank bailout from a central government. God's economic plan involves 50-year cycles, and these 50-year cycles will be enacted to employ economic stability for all societies on the face of the earth. In Leviticus chapter 25, it describes this particular stabilizing effect as the Jubilee year. In verse 8, it says, "You shall count seven Sabbaths of years for yourself, seven times 7 years, and the time of seven Sabbaths of years to you, 49 years. Then you shall cause the trumpet of the Jubilee to sound on the 10th day of the 7th month, on the Day of Atonement." So the Day of Atonement will be celebrated in the millennium, even though Satan has already been put away, because there will be another reason to celebrate the Day of Atonement, especially in the Jubilee year, and that is to understand this year of release. "And you shall make the trumpet to sound throughout all your land. And you shall consecrate the 50th year and proclaim liberty throughout all the land to all its inhabitants. It shall be a jubilee for you, and each of you shall return to his possession, and each of you shall return to his family." Verse 13, "In this year, the jubilee, each one of you shall return to his possessions." So this is going to have a fantastic effect. Jubilee means, from the Jewish Study Bible, homebringing or liberation, just liberation, freedom. In verse 23, it explains how this will actually take place. "The land shall not be sold permanently, for the land is mine." Remember that caveat as a matter of land ownership, that as long as you understand that it's really God's and you can own it, but God really owns it. You're allowed to use it for a while if you obey his economic principles. And it says, "You shall grant redemption of the land. If one of your brethren becomes poor and has sold some of his possession, and if his redeeming relative comes to redeem it, then he may redeem what his brother sold." And that happens in the book of Ruth, as you know. They were at least applying some aspect of the law at that time in ancient Israel. "Or if no one or if the man has no one to redeem it, but he himself becomes able to redeem it, then let him count the years since its sale and restore the remainder to the man to whom he sold it, that he may return to his possession. So according to the number of years, that's how the value will be determined. It'll be a very fair way of determining what the value is and what the exchange of the land. From another translation, it reads, "No exchange of land may be forever, for the land is mine and you are as my guests." So people today can be very possessive about their property, but under God's program, he emphasizes that he alone owns the land. Now, in verse 14, from the New Literal Translation, it says, "When you make an agreement with your neighbor to buy or sell property, you must not take advantage of each other. When you buy land from your neighbor, the price you pay must be based on the number of years since the last jubilee. The seller must set the price by taking into account the number of years remaining until the next year of jubilee. The more years until the next jubilee, the higher the price. The fewer years, the lower the price. After all, the person selling the land is actually selling you a certain number of harvests. So the greater number of harvests that there would be, the greater the value of the land. It just makes sense. Show your fear of God by not taking advantage of each other. I am the Lord your God." So this provision allows restoration to land every 50 years. The other plan that we have talked about in the past is something that, you know, we've mentioned, and it really does make a lot of sense. In Deuteronomy chapter 15, Deuteronomy being a restatement of the law, in Deuteronomy chapter 15 and beginning in verse 1, we find another aspect that will stabilize the economic policies of the world tomorrow. "At the end of every seventh year, you must cancel the debts of everyone who owes you money. This is how it must be done. Everyone must cancel the loans that they have made to their fellow Israelites. They must not demand payment from their neighbors or relatives, for the Lord's time of release has arrived." So contrast that with today's society, in which you're on a hook forever. But contrast it also with the fact that, you know, if somebody is in need and they want to borrow money, how likely is somebody going to lend them money a year out of that seventh year of release? So what will that enforce just by itself as a matter of policy? Greater individual responsibility, which is something that has been lost on much of the Western world. And since the 1930s, it's been lost in terms of people preparing for their future in our nation because they've been reliant on the government to provide for them to a certain extent. Now, they have paid into it, but how much better would it be? And this was the argument politically several years ago and even up to 10 years ago. How much better would a Social Security system be if people had control over their own money and had more interest in developing that and utilizing it in the proper way and developing responsibility themselves? That responsibility has been obviated by government intervention. And anytime the government intervenes, you'll notice this throughout history, government intervenes and a problem becomes worse. And to solve the problem, government proposes that more government intervention be utilized to solve the problem, and it just keeps getting worse and worse and worse and worse. We've got to, and we will, God will return responsibility back to the individual basis so that, you know, you will be responsible for your affairs. Individuals will be responsible for their own affairs in a financial way. So in verse 3, it says, "This release from debt, however, applies only to your fellow Israelites." Oh, wow, that sounds really horrible. That sounds so prejudiced and biased against all the other nations. But God said, "No, you can lend to the Gentile nations. You can even collect interest from them." Why? Because had they really done this, those nations would want to join on to Israel and do the same things. It's not prejudicial in any way. But had they applied this law, they would have been prosperous and wealthy just by the employment of these policies. Now, as it turns out, the United States and British Commonwealth peoples inherited vast material wealth because of a promise God made to Abraham. It wasn't because of judicial use of mentality or principles or anything else. Maybe a few times in our history it was, but we came into possession because God gave us that. We've misused it. There's no doubt about that. So this release from debt applies only to your fellow Israelites, not to the foreigners living among you. There should be no poor among you, for the Lord your God will greatly bless you in the land he is giving you as a special possession. You will receive this blessing if you're careful to obey all the commands of the Lord your God that I'm giving you today. The Lord your God will bless you as he has promised, and you will lend money to many nations, but never need to borrow. You will rule many nations, but they will not rule over you. Now, this principle will undoubtedly be followed, but not restricted to Israel and the world tomorrow. All nations will follow it. The exceptioner for foreigners in Old Testament times was probably to emphasize the blessings of the superiority of God's law over all others of foreign nations. So again, we see a cycle of time, 7 years. And seven is found very often, weekly Sabbath, seven holy days, festivals, land Sabbath. Some people believe, and I think I do, that God designed creation to run on cycles of seven. And in my very limited sphere of medical expertise, I know that in treating a disease like osteoporosis, you know, all through our lifetimes, we replace our skeleton about once every 7 years. It just seems to happen that way. So when you have a young, healthy skeleton, that bone remodeling process is taking place all through your life, and the bone that you're, you know, after you're age 25, by the time you're 35, you've got a brand new, different skeleton. Well, all that bone is in the roughly the same place as it was before, but you've had new bone that's regenerated at least one time during that whole entire process. Freedom from debt is like the impossible dream for most people living in today's world, but it won't be for those living in a world ruled by God, and that is going to be great for them. Land ownership, freedom from debt will be catalyst to completely overhaul and change the world as we have known it. So when we take a look at finances, let's take a look at two more aspects of the economic plan. Our economy today, much of it is run on credit. There's not going to be any need for credit in the same way as there will be in the future. And we have a banking system that is going to be antiquated at that particular time because, you know, as we approach maybe financial calamity someday, what is going to be the first thing to happen for people that do have money? They're going to want to go to the banks and get their money out of the banks, aren't they? Unless they've been wise enough to make some provision ahead of time. You know, I kind of think that if we get to that point, you know, it's really going to be very, very tough. But it's happened in Greece, a run on banks. And so banks are only required to keep a small fraction of money in there, of your deposits. Everything else they've lent out. You remember the old movie with Jimmy Stewart, It's a Wonderful Life. He's got the home savings and loan. And everybody demands, there's a run on the bank, and everybody demands their money all at once. And Jimmy Stewart talks them into, you know, well, Joe, you can't have all your money. You know, part of that money is in Jim's feed store, you know, or whatever he says. My bad Jimmy Stewart imitation. So, but you know that he was able to quell the day. Everybody got a little bit of their money, but that's the way banks operate. You know, if there's a run on cash, you're not going to be able to go to the ATM machine and get all your money out of the bank. That is just not going to happen. It's a failed system, but that's how banks make their money. But in times of economic crisis, there's so many people that want to withdraw their money, the bank doesn't have sufficient cash for everyone, even though it's, quote, insured. Yeah. And so what they'll do is run the printing presses even more. So, again, it's not a godly solution. Turn to Psalm 15 and verse 1. This is a part of one of the shortest songs that we sing in the book. Lord, who may abide in your tabernacle? Who may dwell in your holy hill? Now, I need to complete that by turning to the Psalms myself, because I didn't put the rest of it in there, but it is a fascinating explanation, isn't it? He who walks uprightly, who works righteousness, who speaks the truth in his heart, who does not backbite with his tongue, nor does evil to his neighbor, nor does he take up a reproach against his friend, in whose eyes a vile person is despised, but he honors those who fear the Lord. He who swears to his own hurt and does not change, he who does not put out his money at usury, nor does he take a bribe against the innocent, he who does these things shall never be moved. Can you imagine a world in which no one charges or pays interest? You know, there's not going to be a need then to bail out lending institutions, because they're really simply not going to exist in the way that they operate today. There's not going to be the need. People will, through God's law, become self-sufficient. They'll learn to manage their finances. They'll save money. They may make a few dumb decisions, as we all do in life financially, but eventually they'll make really wise decisions. And the government won't be their nanny trying to guarantee that wisdom. They will simply be self-sufficient. And I'm sure there's going to be times when loans are needed, but lending will be done by God's standards. Now, one of my favorite topics. What about taxes? You know, in our governmental systems of man's government, taxes are basically used to control the populace. Now, I know that there's some beneficial aspects of services that are provided by taxes and that sort of thing, but taxation, especially income tax, is basically a controlling mechanism by governments, and it's something that all of us have grown up with. But there was a time in our country when there was not a thing such as income tax. In fact, there were far fewer taxes years ago than there are now. But many people don't really pay income taxes. And there's this great debate about, now I'm not saying that they don't pay income taxes legally, because they're not required to, because they don't make enough money to reach that threshold to which they are required to pay taxes. But 70% of all taxes brought in by the government are paid by about 10% of the population, of the working population. 10% pay 70% of all revenues coming into the government. So this phony baloney argument of class warfare, where the rich are not paying their fair share, is kind of a silly notion. But really, all taxes are kind of crazy. You get your, let's to make it silly and stupid and easy to understand, you make $100 a week, but you don't really make $100 a week. When you get your paycheck, your taxes have already been deducted for things you don't even understand. You know, there's FICA, there's SS, whatever, I don't know. I mean, I got tired of looking at my paycheck long ago because I thought, wow, there's so much of this that is not mine. This is really sad. You know, you just can't win. You know, it's just unbelievable. So my $100 is not my $100, it's my $67 or my $57. And then after you get that little small $57 amount, you've got to pay taxes on everything else that you buy. And, you know, anything that moves has been taxed somehow. And yet it's still not enough for an ever-burgeoning, ever-growing government. And I don't have time to take you there, but I'll just cite 1 Samuel 8, verses 11 through 17, because for Israel, this was the forerunner of warning. This is what will happen when you have a king or when you have a government. You want a king, you're going to have a central government, you have all these things. You're going to have a tenth taken away here, a tenth there, a tenth there. Your manpower, you're going to have wars, armies, blah, blah, blah. You know, Samuel said it all. And it's come to pass in our modern society as well. And so what will replace that? There's not going to be sales tax. There will not be income tax in the world tomorrow. It will not exist. There's not going to be any corporate tax. There's not going to be an inheritance tax, death tax, gasoline tax. And I'm sure we'll have gasoline, too, or some kind of fuel that'll fuel these driving machines or helicopters or whatever. But God's replacement for all of that will be a flat 20% of profits with no sliding scale, no deductions, and everybody's going to be happy about paying it because they'll be essentially taxed at 10% to pay back to God for the earth that they live on. And Zechariah warns in chapter 14 that if Egypt decides they don't want to save that, they don't want to pay that 10% tithe, okay, the blessings will be withdrawn. I don't think it'll take very long. If they don't want to keep the feast, okay, there will be the power to not bless them accordingly. And then every 2 years out of seven, another 10% for public assistance when necessary. Because wise decisions cannot be mandated. They can only be experienced and determined by the individual. And then you'll get a 10% annual rebate, so to speak, to keep God's festivals. Malachi 3 and verse 8 says, "Can a person rob God? But you're indeed robbing me because you say, 'How are we robbing you?' In tithes and offerings, you're bound for judgment because you are robbing me. This whole nation is guilty." So all nations today are cut off from God's blessings, not just because of administrative decisions, not because of policy decisions, but because they don't have access to this great law and this great stabilizing force for economic prosperity. Verse 10, "Bring the entire tithe into the storehouse so that there may be food in my temple. Test me in this matter, says the Lord who rules over all, to see if I will not open for you all the windows of heaven and pour out for you a blessing until there's no room for it all. Then I will stop the plague from ruining your crops, and all the vine will not lose its fruit before harvest, says the Lord who rules over all. All nations will call you happy, for indeed you will live in a delightful land, says the Lord who rules overall." This prophecy not only explains a key aspect of our economic war woes around the world, but also foretells the utopian way of life during the millennial rule of Christ. People are going to be glad to pay tithes. It's not going to be like, you know, twisting your arm behind your back to, you know, fill out your IRS stupid forms every year, which takes hours and hours and countless hours, even if you have software that's dedicated to make it so easy. And you got to buy that. You got to buy software to make the whole thing easy to be able to give the government their money. It's crazy. Well, anyway, I better get off that soapbox. So we barely scratched the surface of what's going to happen. Here's a few laws that will make all the difference in the world and a few attitudinal changes that will make all the difference in the world. You might call it Bible Economics 101, and there's no need for Bible Economics 102 because once you've mastered this, there's, you know, you've really begun to experience it all. The nice thing is most of you have done everything you can and you're doing everything you can to facilitate these principles in your life, and you've been blessed by it. You really have been blessed by it, and you will be blessed by it. God has designed economic reforms for the millennium that protect and preserve and provide, but they're also there for all of us today in this trouble world, and I have no doubt that if we face dire economic problems and tragedies and consequences, that God will protect every single one of us.